Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. We broadcast each week on the premier channel for transformational talk radio on the Internet, Seventh Wave Network, online at seventhwavenetwork.com. That's where you're listening right now. Movies are changing the way we think, live, and dream. So each week, we showcase today's top independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives. And this week, we're continuing our series of programs about movies with a strong social conscience and a willingness to take risks. Today I have as my guest Deborah Coons Garcia, producer and director of The Future of Food, a very timely documentary that offers an in-depth investigation into the disturbing truth behind the unlabeled, patented, genetically engineered foods that have quietly filled U.S. grocery store shelves for the past decade. Deborah, welcome to the show. Hi, can you guys turn her up a little bit? I can't hear it too well. Well, one of the things that really took me about your film, Deborah, is that you took a very complex idea about food in our modern age, and you've made a very easily understandable and very comprehensive documentary that explores the issue quite completely. So first of all, congratulations on making a great film.
Thank you.
And I wanted to, the first question I usually ask my guests is, of all the ideas that you could do a film about being a filmmaker, you've had a history of that, doing that for quite some time in your professional life, what brought you to make a film about this subject?
Well, I became a vegetarian in 1970 when I was in college and became really interested back then in the relationship between food and health and food and social justice issues. So I always had it in my mind that I wanted to make a film about agriculture, and I thought it would be a certain kind of thing about, you know, chemical versus organic agriculture and that kind of thing. And then when I started making the film, it was about 6 years ago when I started researching it and figuring out what I wanted to do, I found out about genetically engineered organisms and that Monsanto was buying up seed companies and that they could patent DNA. And if that DNA got on your property, you would have to pay the people who hold the patent a license fee. And I didn't know any of that. And I felt that I was a very informed consumer, you know, eating organic food and feeling like I was just so hip. I knew all about it and I knew absolutely nothing about it. So the film I was going to make, which was going to be more sort of general, actually turned into something which I really wanted people to understand what was going on with genetically engineered food, you know, what it was, how it was made, and all the different implications of that, all the way from the, you know, from the molecular level all the way up to the global level. So that became my focus.
Well, one of the things that I found out that was very revealing to me was, as you talked about the history of agriculture, you started at the beginning with the way that ancient people farmed and the great variety of different vegetables that have been grown in all over the world for centuries. And I didn't know that there were like 5,000 varieties of potatoes and over 7,000 varieties of apples that were grown in the U.S. alone. And that was something I was completely unaware of.
Right, there were just huge varieties of fruits and vegetables and grains, just incredible variety of things. And so it's interesting because, you know, we know that we want biodiversity, and I actually think before I started working on this film, I thought biodiversity was kind of a good idea. You know, I thought it was kind of like a moral thing. It was the reason why we should have biodiversity and try to save all these different kinds of plants and animals and ecosystems and everything. But the reality is, as far as food goes, is that if a certain kind of corn is attacked with a kind of a blight or a disease or a certain insect likes it, what we need to do is find another kind of corn that's naturally resistant to it, and that's what people did. And if you have hundreds of varieties of things, then you can do that. But if you only have five varieties, then you know you're going to find yourself in trouble. So it's a kind of it has to do with our food security to protect our biodiversity, and that's not something I didn't really quite realize that until I focused on it, because we don't know. I mean, if you're not a farmer and you're not involved in agriculture, you don't realize that, you know, these fields of monocrops where they're growing one crop, you know, a whole country could grow one kind of potato or one kind of wheat, and if that ends up being susceptible to a certain a disease that's mutated, then basically you lose everything. That's why famines are caused a lot of times, is because a certain disease attacks the monoculture, which is why monocultures are so dangerous.
Yeah, just to explain, a monoculture is when you're growing one crop, like all wheat or all corn or something like that.
Right, on huge amounts of acres, you know, thousands of acres of something.
Right.
Yeah, which is it's not the way nature does it. It actually leaves itself much more open to problems and disease.
Yeah, in the film you say that monoculture, agriculture, created an ecological vacuum that insects and disease could exploit.
That's right, yeah.
And then because of that, farmers got on the pesticide treadmill, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so the uniformity led to agricultural catastrophes like the potato famine in Ireland in the 1800s.
Right, that's right, because they were growing one kind of potato, and a blight hit that potato, they lost everything. Of course, what we didn't have time to explain in the film, which we had to cut out, is that the political situation in Ireland at that time was such that the English had pretty much taken over Ireland, or sort of basically colonized it, and they were still shipping out wheat and cattle at the same time that the Irish were dying, because the Irish were supposed to be only eating the potatoes. So, you know, when a lot of this stuff, these famines and food problems, there is a biological issue there, but if you look at the larger picture, there's also often a political and economic issue behind it.
Yeah, so as we wrap up this idea talking about monocultures and agriculture, one of the statements you make in the film is that 97% of the vegetables grown in the 20th century are now extinct.
Right. The beginning of the 20th century.
That's frightening. So
yeah.
It's just amazing to me that people don't understand, when you go to the grocery store and you're seeing maybe about maybe two or three dozen types of vegetables that you can buy, there's thousands more that we could be growing that we're not growing.
Right, and a lot of times those decisions of what corporate agriculture grows has to do with, you know, how they ship. Not, you know, it doesn't have to do with taste. The kind of red delicious apple is the classic example of that. I think probably the original red delicious apples were good, but it turned into this thing where they tasted like no taste at all, and they just kind of looked like they had been, I don't know what, you know, manufactured rather than grown. But, you know, I think that this trend, there's a lot of... you know, as you know, and I'm sure all your listeners know, that, you know, there's a huge push now towards more varieties of fruits and vegetables and farmers markets and things like that, where people can actually, like, find that. Like, heirloom tomatoes is a good example. Just, what, 10 years ago, you'd get the same cardboard tomato year-round, wherever it was grown. And now, most places in the summer have really a nice array of wonderful different colors and shapes of tomatoes. In fact, I was just at the store a little while ago, and they're out now here in California, and it's just, so people love that. You know, they love the variety, and I think that the demand for that and the appreciation for that is changing the marketplace. Of course, not with the industrial crops, but more on a personal and local level, which is great.
I wanted to ask you a question where I want to come back to the filmmaking aspect just for a moment. One of the things that how I first noticed your film, because I didn't know about it, is that I was actually shopping at Whole Foods here in Phoenix, and I saw your film displayed. It's actually been displayed for several months now.
Yeah.
In their section where they have a TV and they run movies. So how did you get that to happen?
That's a funny story. I basically stalked down one of the co-presidents of Whole Foods, Walter Robb. I mean, not really, but I showed the film quite a bit. It has a really interesting history, because I wanted to make a serious film, and I wanted to make a film that had an impact. And this film was before the Inconvenient Truth, you know, phenomenon. It was kind of before that started really happening. And so I showed it a lot, and it was very well received, you know, in the filmmaking world and also in the ag world. And so I showed it. It opened at Film Forum in New York, which is, you know, really an amazing theater. But even at the same time, it played at the Upper Midwest Organic Farmers Convention, and it played at EcoFarm, and it played at the big, you know, organic food conventions. And there's a big one in Chicago and another one down outside of L.A., and it played there. And so people were aware of it, and then I managed to basically get, you know, Walter Robb to watch it, and then John Mackey watched it, and they decided that this was an important issue that they hadn't really been so aware of, you know, and they mandated that all the stores carry it, which is over 200 stores, which was fabulous for me, of course, for my bottom line and getting the film out there. And it was good for them, too, because I talked to John Mackey a couple months ago, and he said, oh, we made a lot of money off that film. You know, documentary filmmakers love to hear that. I thought it was pretty good for our bottom line, too. And more important, it makes people really appreciate organic, and it makes people appreciate organic farmers. And to understand these complicated issues that are kind of being decided somewhere else, you know, they're being decided in Washington, they're being decided in, you know, the Monsanto corporate boardroom, and for people to really understand that they're ending up with the results of all these decisions that are being made out there. And if they don't like it, then, you know, we need to understand how we can say no, aside from just, you know, because with food, you know, you can say no by not buying it at the grocery store, but we have to really affect the system, because if we don't really affect the system, we're not going to have a choice. That what's going to be there is what's
right.
going to be there.
As you say in the film, the choices we make at the supermarket determine the future of food. It's really about our buying power. And one of the things that was really positive in the movie, before we get, and we're about to kind of get into the more somber and serious issues that are dealt with in the movie, I want to start with a positive note. And that positive note is, talk about the story of the consumer response that kept genetically engineered foods out of organic standards. Talk about that happened several years ago.
Right. Well, back in the 90s, you know, the organic standards, there wasn't no real federal organic standards, and people wanted that. I mean, at the time, a lot of people thought that would be a good idea. So they, you know, there are a lot of good people on the boards that were making those decisions, but nevertheless, whatever they said they wanted, when the government came out with the, you know, this is what we want for organic standards, they were going to allow genetically engineered food and also sewage sludge and, you know, irradiated food. And that was back in the late 90s, you know, like I think it's 96 or 97. And people wrote to the government, and this was before email was really all that big, and people, hundreds of thousands of people wrote the government and said, no, 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 we don't want it. And so they didn't. They removed those from being allowed in the standards, which is great. You know, it really shows that people were paying attention. And speaking of Whole Foods, I know my local Whole Foods, they had something you could sign there that they were going to send to the government to protect the organic standards. So that was, and all kinds of organizations got people to write in. That was a really good example of consumers having a say and the government listening. So that was quite positive.
Right.
And also it upped the whole profile of organic and made people realize, wow, there's a difference between organic and non-organic. And then it set these standards, which then, you know, now people are, you know, that's a whole other issue is standards and what those really mean, because those organic standards that, you know, you can have something that's grown without pesticides and it can be labeled organic, but the, you know, the farm itself, like the farm workers may not be treated well, and, you know, the conditions of the farm, like you can have organic cows that aren't, you know, that are kind of, you know, you can have organic meat that's not grown in a really healthy situation. So now people are going back and they're saying, well, what does organic mean? Is it just without pesticides, or does it mean there's social justice? Does what about animal cruelty? You know, there's a whole other discussion going on now about the deeper issue of organic, like beyond organic, the sort of non, you know, everything aside from is it grown without pesticides. So it's still a hot topic, you know. Still a lot of controversy about it.
There's definitely a lot of controversy.
Yeah, and also just to say, you know, because organic is very big business now, it's the fastest growing segment of the food industry, and, you know, everybody wants organic. There's not enough organic for all the people that want to buy it. So they're growing organic in China and shipping it over, and, you know, then that's a controversy. Well, what? How do we know, you know? And the people who have some power and are getting stuff from China, know that it, you know, they go over there and check it out and make sure that everything is grown properly. But then that's a whole other thing, is what's going on in these other countries that we're getting organic food from. Do they have the same standards that we have?
Well, one of the things from the farmer's perspective that's mentioned in the film is, as they sort of give a definition to what it is organic means, mm-hmm. it's thinking about the relationship of the human relationship to agriculture.
Right.
And respecting nature's logic.
Right.
And that would be, to me, that really says what organic farming and sustainable agriculture is about. It's that we put ourselves in the equation. It's not that those are the plants and this is the human being. It's that there's a symbiotic relationship happening.
That's right. Yeah, and also as far as the land that's growing that food goes, the ideal situation is to put back into that soil and into that land what you take out of it. You have to kind of feed the soil, which then grows the plant. And, you know, that can be, you know, that's a whole other thing about, you know, if you're taking stuff, you know, if you're just living in a self-contained farm, what you take out you can put back in because you're not really taking out that much. If it's a commercial farm and you're shipping off a lot of the, you know, the stuff that you're growing, then how are you going to replenish the soil, you know, with that stuff? So that whole idea of soil fertility and how you maintain a healthy, organic, sustainable system, it's actually pretty complex because you do have to give back to the earth and you do have to, you can't just take, because then you end up with diminishing, you know, then you end up with soil that's not as fertile.
As indigenous cultures say, we need to respect the earth.
Exactly.
And that we have a part in it. We're not, we're not dominating nature. We're actually a part of it. And so, you know, in our modern culture, with all this, you know, the religiosity that's happened, we've sort of forgotten that. And I think that people are really beginning to rediscover that in our modern age, that, you know, as we hear more from indigenous cultures around the world, you know, in the news media, on the radar screen, people are reading, and the internet is a great tool for people to get information and really get an in-depth information with some clarity, hopefully for people who've done their job and done their research. I want to get into now about the sort of what I would say more somber or sometimes I would say very sad aspects of what's happening today. Because the film distills the complex technology and also the key regulatory, legal, ethical, environmental, and consumer issues surrounding the changes happening today. The patenting of life, the corporatization of food. So one of the things that you mentioned in the film that people don't realize is that in 1978, the patenting of seeds began. Talk a little bit about what happened then.
Yeah, there was a case that came up, Chakrabarty, who worked for GE, and he genetically engineered a bacteria that was supposed to eat, an organism that was supposed to eat oil, and he put it in for a patent, and the patent office said no, because this is a living organism, we can't patent life. And so he took it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that you could patent life, and that really opened the door to all kinds of things, including, you know, patenting DNA, like they've patented one of the genes responsible for breast cancer. So if people want to research and use that gene, they have to get permission and pay a patent fee. So what happened with the Chakrabarty decision is that basically people can patent life, they can patent plants, they can patent DNA, and I think that the difference between that is that people, plant breeders, used to be able to protect their work. You know, if you grew a certain kind of rose, somebody couldn't just, you know, immediately take exactly that rose and make money off it. But they weren't patents, they were more plant protection fees. And the most important thing is they didn't extend to the offspring of that plant. So, you know, the problem with patents now is that they patent a seed and you can't replant that seed. You can't, you know, you can't get seeds from the plant that grows from that seed and replant those because they own that DNA. And you have to go back and get permission or pay a patent fee in order to replant your seeds. And this puts a huge burden on farmers because most farmers in the world do replant their seeds. And so, I mean, it gets so complicated. So what these big corporations do is they go down into countries in South America and places in India, and they buy up the farmer's seed supply, their own local seeds. They buy it up for a huge price, and they come along with Monsanto seeds that, you know, are supposed to be used with Roundup and are very expensive. And they get the people hooked on those, and they can't replant them. They have to go back every year and buy the seed. So they've lost their autonomy. And then the other important issue about this that's really frightening is if you're a farmer next to you is growing genetically engineered corn, and that pollen goes into your garden or your field and contaminates it with this genetically engineered corn, you're actually violating Monsanto's patent by having that in your field, even though you don't want it there and you didn't put it there. In fact, you consider that to be a liability if you're an organic farmer. Nevertheless, you know, they can sue you and get money out of you. They own those crops. It's just incredible. I mean, it doesn't even make sense, but that's the way the system is.
Yeah, and you profile in the film with a story of a farmer in Saskatchewan, Percy Schmeiser.
Percy Schmeiser, yeah.
Yeah.
And
that,
another
that happened to him when he was growing canola and found out that Monsanto went on his land and took samples and said, "Well, this is our patented, you know, seed here, and it's growing on your land, and you don't have a permit for it or whatever."
Right. Right, and then we profiled an American farmer who had a similar situation with soy. Yeah. So
this is farmers must be hearing these stories of what's happening to our farmers who are wonderfully dedicated people and committed and who really care about what they do tremendously. That this labeling, patenting of life, and is just really changing agriculture to a tremendous degree. And the other thing is that people don't realize, looking at farms, is that you make this point in the film, is that whoever controls the seeds controls the food.
Yeah, the whole issue of what's going on with seeds now is just, it is such a huge and important issue because, you know, these corporations have gone up and bought up seed supplies. Most of the seed germplasm in the United States is owned by corporations. And the thing of it is if they buy up, you know, if they control, you know, hundreds or thousands of types of a certain seed, they have no obligation to make all those available to people. They can just put out the one that they want to put out, which inevitably, you know, if they have it, it's going to be genetically engineered, which people can't replant. So, and I've heard stories from farmers that like a certain kind of soybean, and they've grown it and it grows well, and they're farming Nebraska, and so they order that soybean and they don't want it GE, and when the bags are delivered, it's GE, and they call up and they say, you know, I don't want genetically engineered soy, I just want this kind of soy that I've been growing. And the seed seller says, no, well, this is only made genetically engineered now, so if you want this, you're going to have to get it GE. So it's just, you know, it really, it's a huge issue, and it's a huge issue all over the world because, you know, they're going out there and really trying to control the seed supplies of countries like India, you know, which is known for its huge variety of seeds. And they're, you know, it's kind of like this whole idea of, you know, what we were talking about earlier, this monoculture where you grow one type of seed, and because that's not a natural environment to have one thing growing, you know, for, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres, you have to have a lot of chemicals and you have to have a lot of fertilizers, and, you know, you move into that whole industrial corporate world, and you're basically growing, you basically have a factory, except it happens to be on a field, you know, but basically it's a factory. It's not nature. So it's just a lot of complex issues come together in this.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned, you just mentioned that is about chemical fertilizer. And I want to just make the point so people really understand exactly what happened, because, of course, those who haven't seen the film and who don't know a lot about the subject, is that the companies that were making pesticides and herbicides have become the companies that have actually bought the seeds. So
right.
The pesticide industry bought the seed industry in the 1990s.
That's it. And they're still buying stuff up. Yeah, that's it. The pesticide industry basically controls our seed supply. Yeah.
So think about that, folks. I mean, does that sound
yeah.
Does that make sense to you? Does this sound like something that we want to, you know, keep allowing to happen? I mean, obviously it's hurting farmers all over the world, And then one of the other things that Monsanto is definitely dedicated not to have happen is they don't want genetically altered food labeled. So let's get into this issue about labeling, because in the European Union, all 15 countries of the EU adopted rules for requiring the labeling of genetically engineered foods.
That's
and we
right.
haven't.
That's right. Yeah, they have really blocked the labeling of GE, because there's three things they say about genetically engineered foods. They say, we've been doing this kind of breeding for thousands of years, it's been thoroughly tested, and it's exactly the same as regular food. And if you see the film, or if you really understand how this works, the way that they make genetically engineered crop, the way they genetically engineer something is they take pieces of bacteria and viruses from a variety of sources, and they put them together in this genetic cassette. And part of that is the DNA that they're trying to engineer into the new thing. But they need all these other elements in order to make the technology work. So it's,
Well, just simple. Also, so if you can imagine like a pie, and so what they do is you take a piece out of that pie and you're inserting something else, like you're inserting a cherry piece into an apple pie, and you want it to become something else. And so it takes on a new form and a new life and so forth. And so one of the things that one of the scientists mentioned is that as these transgenetic manipulations happen, that more and more the pieces of the DNA interacting with each other are interacting in ways sometimes that are totally unpredictable.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, and that's true. And the thing of it is that it's not only that you're putting the piece of cherry pie in the apple pie. There's all these other things that are going in there too. They make it sound like it's just so exact, but it's not exact. And in fact, even to create a genetically engineered organism that's functional, they have to make tens of thousands. They make tens of thousands that don't work, and they find one that works, and then that's the one that they put out there. So I guess my point earlier was that this, they say it's exactly the same, and because they said to the government it's exactly the same, then it fell under this generally recognized as safe, GRAS category in terms
right.
of our
and
food. Right,
and the government doesn't require labeling or testing on GRAS.
Yeah, so that's how it got it. And most people don't realize they've ever eaten now maybe they do, but even just a year or two ago, most people think they've never eaten genetically. Most Americans think they've never eaten genetically engineered food. They don't even know it's there. And when they find out it's there, these are government focus groups, they're outraged. And what they did in Europe is when they started bringing in genetically engineered food into England, there's a group there called the Women's Institute, which is all over England, and I kind of imagine them as kind of older ladies in their hats and things like that. And they found out that this GE was coming into the supermarkets, and so they decided they wanted it labeled. So they had this campaign where they would go into the grocery store, Friday afternoon and do a big shop, and then when they got to the checkout, they would say, well, now I want to go through each of these and find out, which has genetic engineered elements in it, because I don't want those. So we'll just go through these one by one. Of course, the cashiers are going, we don't know what the managers are going. So
I want to come back to the issue about labeling just for a second here, and you finish that story. We're going to take.
So
a
that's
break.
How they got it labeled. They got it labeled because they actually went into the grocery stores and ended up, creating shopping anarchy.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back with talking about the future of food with producer-director Deborah Coons-Garcia right after this break in a couple minutes. Stay with us.
Awakened Media for a transforming world. Seventh Wave Network.
If you've experienced the power of The Secret and are ready to take it one step further, then it's time to tune into Good Vibes, Bad Vibes, an empowering new show on the 7th Wave Network, live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Good Vibes, Bad Vibes peers into the world of vibrations and reveals just how these energy patterns are manifesting both positive and negative life experiences in our health, finances, environment, and most importantly, our own personal evolution. Join traditional naturopathic practitioners Gay Hilton and George Juhas to unveil the mysteries of instant and attractions as well as dislikes. Find out how your energy field can work to manifest success in your finances and retirement. Good Vibes, Bad Vibes will direct your vibrational journey towards mastery of life's greatest mysteries, the quantum world of vibration. Join hosts Dr. Hilton and Juhas and their intoxicating guests every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern, right here on the 7th Wave Network. Improve your spiritual well-being and experience a new way of looking at spirituality and wellness. Tune into Spiritual Evolution with spiritual counselor, healer, and animal communicator, Kelly Marie. Each week, Kelly and her guests explore spiritual problem solving and connecting balance between the body and spirit. Spiritual Evolution with Kelly Marie, broadcast every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the 7th Wave Network, your online community for positive change. Spiritual Evolution, expanding the boundaries and broadening the vision of spirituality through inspiration and education. The last great frontier is the magnificent mystery of the mind. Abundant evidence demonstrates that we have far more talents than we realize, and that our minds are exceptional instruments we can learn to use more fully, just as we've learned to play a piano or a clarinet. Tune in to The Music of Your Mind, Living the Extraordinary, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the 7th Wave Network, and learn more about how you can hear the wonderful music of your mind.
Awakened Media for a transforming world. Seventh Wave Network.
Back. I just took a drink of water. I'm a little, didn't swallow it properly. Hi, everyone. I'm Randall Libero, and you're listening to Spirit of Film Conversations. We're talking today about the revolution happening in farm fields and on the dinner tables of America, a revolution that is transforming the very nature of the food we eat. We're talking about the future of food with producer and director Deborah Coons Garcia. Hi, welcome back to the show, Deborah. Hi, Deborah. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more as you're listening to the program, you can go to the website, thefutureoffood.com, where you can find out more and where you can get a copy of the DVD if you want to take a look at this wonderful film. One of the things that we were discussing before the break was about the labeling of genetically engineered food. And I want to, we're talking about what's been happening in Europe and the European Union, where genetically modified foods are actually labeled on packaging, and they're not here in the United States. And the reason for that, as you mentioned in the film, has to do with something that the companies who own the patents for genetically engineered food don't want to have happen, which is they don't want to be liable if people actually have health reactions to eating the food.
Yeah, that's a good point, because that's true. If it were labeled and people start having allergies to certain things, they might start looking at that as a possibility. And yeah, it's the labeling issue. It does work both ways in terms of people being able to choose what they're eating, and also accountability. Exactly.
So labeling is the way that we can trace the health effects, and that traceability is the issue. Genetically engineered foods, and that is the key way that to get corporations liable for these health effects. So one of the things I found interesting in the film is that you mentioned that a trade representative from Japan says they're going to watch U.S. children over the next 10 years to see, the reactions to our food supply, and especially from foods that are processed and packaged that are on supermarket shelves.
Right. Well, the Japanese are totally against GE. They really don't want it at all. And I think that's really true. And it's hard to know exactly what it is that's causing all these health problems that we have in America now, but I know in children there are so many more allergies now than there were even 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, huge allergies. It's not uncommon for half of a soccer team to have their asthma inhalers, when they're playing. It's really quite shocking, and it's hard to know, is it some kind of toxic load from just the environment that people live in, or the pesticides that are on, the non-organic foods?
Or excitotoxins, as we interviewed Corey Brackett and J.T. Waldron about their film Sweet Misery a few weeks ago on this program, and they were talking about the in our food supply the use of aspartame and MSG and excitotoxins and their effects on the body.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just incredible, not even to mention corn syrup and diabetes, you know. It's really quite shocking. And, you know, this is the first time I think that people realize that their children are actually going to be less healthy than their parents when they get older. You know, it's kind of we're actually heading towards a more unhealthy population, which is really pretty shocking. And you know, then you go into this whole thing of the school food program. That's a whole other issue, and the fact that the school food program is controlled by the USDA. It's not controlled by the educational system. It's controlled by the Department of Agriculture, and they put into that system food that's heavily subsidized. So basically, the corporations control our school food now, and it's a battle that a lot of parents are fortunately wanting to get into to demand healthy food for their children, because they're not, you know, a lot of schools are not feeding kids what I think they should have, which is fresh food.
And right, and I'm seeing it.
Junk food.
Yeah, they're especially in California, in the state of California, there was the move towards taking a lot of stack machines out of schools.
Right. Well,
people are beginning to realize there's something going on, because they're seeing new illnesses, new diseases happening. You're seeing kids, like I mentioned a few weeks ago in the show with Corey and JT. When I was in school, you very rarely saw a kid that was obese. But today, it's very common. You go into the supermarket, and people are—they're just over. There's so many people that are overweight,
yeah.
And it's because, it's because of what they're eating. I mean, it has to be. There's no other. I mean, environmental factors, genetic, predisposition, fine. But there's too much of it going on for these, other two items to be totally at fault. There's got to be something else. And so people are beginning to wise up. They're making wiser choices. They're starting to support sustainable agriculture. They're starting to buy organic. I mean, the sales of organic food have skyrocketed over the past 10 years. So people are beginning to know that something is going on. And so, they're starting to get the message. And thank God for films like yours to really give people a true understanding of the total issue and the political just crash that's happening in this country, that's the taking over, things that we depend on and have depended on for decades, we no longer can, depend on. We have to take more responsibility for pretty much everything in our lives, because all these corporations and the government are making decisions that are not in our favor.
That's right. And I think that one of the great things about food is it is something that we can make a choice about. I mean, there are some people in situations, like in inner cities, that don't have a choice because they don't have supermarkets there. If they want to eat, they have to eat, some kind of, fast food. But most of us have the ability to choose what we buy and what we eat. And I think that is, that's the real power. We have that power as consumers. And I also think that people need to be aware that the Farm Bill is coming up for renewal this fall. And a lot of what we eat and what appears in the supermarkets is determined by what's subsidized by our tax dollars in the Farm Bill. And I think, and that's why there's so much corn syrup, because corn is heavily subsidized. That's the reason why beef is so cheap, because when corn and, when grains are subsidized, then the beef can eat really cheaply. And then, it's really cheap beef, and that's why it's cheaper to buy a hamburger than it is to eat a regular meal. So there are a lot of complex issues, but I think that it is an area, food, in terms of, voting with your fork, voting with your dollar, and I also think voting with your vote. I think we need to make our representatives realize that, if our tax dollars are going to be going out into this world of food and farming, we want it to go to family farms. We want it to go to farms that grow healthy food and, not food that's going to end up, not stuff that's going to end up in junk food. And I think we need to really start educating ourselves and also just start making a lot of noise, because that's the only way you get any attention these days.
Right, right. So multinational corporations are taking over worldwide by consolidating our food supply.
Right.
And that's, as you mentioned, the corporatization of food, like the merging of Kraft and Nabisco, And the other thing that people see when they, sometimes they'll be watching television, they'll see some public service announcement or whatever, talking about genetically engineered foods and how they're good for you and how they're going to end world hunger. And one of the points that you make in the film is that the introduction of GM crops to the world's poorest countries, it could actually lead to famine instead of feeding the 800 million people worldwide that are starving.
Right, right. Well, a lot of it is, you know, yeah, and the other issue about that is important about genetically engineered food, for one thing, the crops, it doesn't, genetic engineering doesn't improve yield. In fact, in some cases, if the plants are stressed, there's actually less yield. So this idea that, you know, it's actually, you know, a better crop that way, you know, quantitatively is just not true. And the other problem is that these foods have not been tested properly for health. The promoters of them say they have. They just say that. But the fact is, they haven't been. And the only testing that's been done, the corporations do it themselves. They summarize the results and they hand them into the government. And the government basically, the government doesn't issue a statement that says, we think these are safe. They basically say, yeah, we've read these summaries. You know what I mean? When you actually look at the language. So there have been no proper health tests on these, either on animals or on humans, except for, you know, of course, we are the experiment. They're experimenting on the populations of the countries that eat these. And the other thing is that the people that I know, whose opinion I respect, think that if say in Africa you send this GE corn there, which is, you know, no countries, they don't want to buy our GE corn. Europe doesn't.
Right, they didn't want this. Europe said no to Starlink corn, all of that. I mean, that was in the news. People know about that story.
Yeah, they don't want it. So farmers in America, you know, they've lost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars by growing these GE crops. So one of the things they do is our government buys it from the farmers for food aid and ships it off to Africa. And what my friends say who are really experts in this is that if someone's challenged anyway because they're starving and you send them genetically engineered corn, all they're supposed to eat is just this one kind of genetically engineered corn, we don't really know what effect that's going to have on their bodies. We don't know, you know, that may not be the best thing for these people to eat. So, and then the whole issue of why they're starving in the first place, because of these botched agricultural policies, which set them up to grow things for export, but found out that because our crops are subsidized, they can't sell it on the world market because it costs more for an African to grow cotton than it does for an American cotton farmer, because the American cotton farmer is heavily subsidized. So there's just so many complex issues, but, you know, I think that, you know, Americans need to kind of start paying attention to it, because we're really the ringleader in this whole, you know, kind of takeover mentality.
We definitely are. We own the companies, Monsanto, they own so many patents, and it's funny, looking at, there's a part of the movie where you actually show how people who worked for Monsanto have become, in the upper echelons of certain agencies in our government.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we did it with this revolving door, because everybody says it's a revolving door, so I thought, well, let's just do the revolving door. But, you know, of course, we're so cynical about that now, with the whole arms, you know, all these arms merchants and, you know, all this, you know, Halbert and all this stuff. We're just so cynical about it. But nevertheless, you know, it's pretty shocking when you look at the number of people in the government who work for, you know, they like work for Monsanto, they go into the government, they rubber stamp some policy that benefits Monsanto, back to the government, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. A lot of the people that are making decisions about what goes on in agriculture are from big ag. It's just like, you know, people making decisions about our energy policy are big oil. I mean, we're so cynical about it, but it doesn't change the fact that, you know, as citizens, I don't think know that a lot of those people that, I mean, there are, I think that there are good people in the government who work inside these agencies, like the people.
Oh, there definitely are. I used to work for the State Department many years ago in the 1990s, and I met some wonderful people who were very, what I would call the true Americans, and they really respect this country. And
right.
they're in all agencies of the government. It's just that they're sometimes not in positions where they can do anything.
Well, the political appointees, who are the people at the very top, you know, who set the policy, are you know, they're the ones. In fact, there have been, there's been a lot of notice recently about, I think in the FDA, I think some people in the FDA I don't know, did they, like, or the EPA, one of those, I think they actually sued the agency because they felt like the agency wasn't taking proper care. You know, they weren't really paying attention to the things they should have been paying attention to. They kind of sloughed off on the rules. So, even though we're cynical about it, it doesn't mean that we have to accept it and keep on this way and end up, you know, being colonized by these corporations, this corporatocracy.
Yeah, because one of the things that you bring up in the film, which really is, I think, one of the saddest parts of the film, you talked about a patent, a gene patent that has to do with something that's called a terminator technology, a suicide gene that's been put into crops where you cannot save the seed because the seed becomes sterile.
Right, right. It renders the seed sterile so that seed, that plant cannot reproduce. And that was, you think of it, if that technology escaped and started, you know, crossing over into other plants.
And cross-polluting other crops that were good.
Right.
Ultimately, it could lead to some very scary consequences where food doesn't grow anymore.
That's right. And that's the scary thing. And there was such an outcry against it when people first found out about it. Several years ago, back in the 90s, there was a huge outcry all over the world to block it. And so the developers said, okay, we won't develop anymore. And then I think it was a year or two ago, they were at it again, and the U.S. government was at it, saying, oh, we want to do the Terminator. And so,
well, the U.S. government is a co-owner on the Terminator patent.
That's right.
So, you know, they're always making decisions that are in their best interest and so forth.
Who knows? I mean,
But that was, I mean, just thinking about the ultimate consequences of something like that if it just got out of hand. Because as we were talking about before, when the genetic manipulation is done, a lot of the, here's getting a little bit into the science here, the actual marker genes that they use to complete the genetic engineering technique are actually viruses and they're things that which actually cause disease, and they're putting them into the DNA at the DNA level to make the DNA pieces fit together.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's two issues about that. One is there's an antibiotic marker gene that's put in there so that they can test and see if the transformation, the genetic engineering, has actually taken place. And so they treat it with this antibiotic, and because it's antibiotic resistant, you know, then they can tell whether or not it's in there. And that has a lot of people freaked out because we don't want people exposed to more and more antibiotics, because then they become resistant to antibiotics when they really need it. So that's an issue. And then the other issue is this cauliflower mosaic gene, this promoter gene that they put in there, which is from a disease called cauliflower mosaic virus, which creates tumors on plants. And they put this in the genetic cassette because when you put a piece of DNA in this cassette that's really not supposed to be there, then it's not going to express itself. So what this mosaic virus, this promoter does, it attaches itself to that and forces it to express itself. It's kind of like supercharging it because it doesn't really want to do it, so it forces it to express itself. And there's a scientist in Europe who's researching that, and he told me last summer that there's a that this may be an oncogene. In other words, if this gets into somebody's gut, which it would be if they're eating the food, and happens to attach onto a gene of theirs that may have the possibility of turning into a cancer or may not, then this promoter gene may increase the possibility that it will turn into a cancer. Because it's attached to this, it's like saying, go, 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 you know, create, create, create. And so, you know, it just seems so foolish to go forward with these technologies that haven't been properly tested, where people are eating massive amounts of this, and it's just, so there's a, you know, it's, yeah, so I think the health consequence, the thing that, you know, having dealt with this issue for a few years now, I think the patenting thing freaks me out completely. The Monsanto buying up the seed, you know, all these corporations, basically, there's Monsanto, Syngenta, you know, there's about three or four of them that basically have been buying up all the seeds of the planet, and then the health consequences of this, and the fact that they haven't been properly tested, in spite of the fact that the corporations say they have, when you really examine it, they haven't. And those three things, each of those things is huge, but altogether it just merely makes it look like it's some weird conspiracy to, I don't know what, I guess take over the food supply. I think that's because that we all need food, so if they can control the food you know, by controlling the seeds and controlling the food supply, then they'll have us, you know.
Well, as I say, if you watch television at night, there's commercials, and it actually goes back and forth between, you know, commercials about food and the commercials about pharmaceutical drugs.
It's
back
just,
and forth, back and forth.
I know. I mean, it's incredible. It's sort of like the same companies that make, you know, they want us to be sick, so we have to buy the medicine from them.
Well, they're making food that makes us sick, so we have to buy the drugs.
Exactly. I think they want us all on something. I think their ideal is to have us all on something so that we, you know,
so that we become dependent.
Totally.
And that they stay in control.
It's it.
But,
that's it.
But you know what? As you and I both know, and as you say in the end, towards the end of the film, you talk about solutions and what's going on today, about the consumer interest in pure food, about the support for organic agriculture, and that there's a good food revolution going on as well. So let's end on a positive note here. Talk about some of the great things that are going on today on the positive side of this issue, where people are beginning to take control, and about the sustainable food movement, and where are these things headed, do you think?
Well, that is the really exciting thing, is that the whole sustainable and organic movement is just huge. It's really booming, and everybody wants to get on board, you know, for better or for worse. Walmart is the biggest seller of organic food in the world today. So it is really happening, and people want it. And I think that is really, really exciting. And farmers markets are a great example of that. There are farmers markets all over the place where people can actually meet the farmer that's growing the food. And also CSAs, community support agriculture, where they get a box delivered from the same farm, you know, throughout the year. And I think that these are really exciting things for people, because not only is the food good, and not only does it provide people, you know, with a sense of community, but it allows them to feel that they have some control over their environment, and it's very positive in every possible way. And I think that, you know, I think that this whole idea of security now, we're all very concerned about our security. Well, we all need to be concerned about our food security, because if we run out of oil, or if some reason our oil supply is cut off, you know, our whole food system is dependent on oil. We are afloat on a sea of oil. I think the more people find out about where their food comes from and try to source more local food and support local farms, so that, you know, if everything completely falls apart, at least, you know, this town will be able to feed itself. And that's one of the really exciting things that's happening in Europe, and a little bit here now, is these people in communities, in towns, in cities, are trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to survive in the next decades, you know, if things are cut back? Where is our food coming from? What are we supporting with our dollars? And I think they're kind of called power down. We're trying to, you know, not ship apples from China, but get them from, you know, the farm down the road. So it's pretty exciting what's happening, and it's kind of separate from this whole corporate, you know, machinery that I think is so out of control. I mean, I don't even think they're that together. I think that whole thing is going to fall apart. But, you know, we can source locally and have a good time doing it. And I think it's really a great time to be eating in America, if you're able to have those choices or demand those choices, because
demand those choices. Like we said at the beginning of the program, that, you know, people still, they can have an effect, just like the organic standards that we were talking about earlier in the show. So don't give up hope. One of the things that I want to just kind of go over very quickly here at the end, we're getting close to the end of the program, and of course thefutureoffood.com is the site where you can get the film and find out more. If people want to get seeds to, like, grow in their own garden, they don't want, you know, these patented seeds, where would they go to find them?
Well, I think, there's a great organization called the Organic Seed Alliance, and you can go on their website and find out. And there's some really great seed savers organizations all over the place. And I think if you try to find an organic farm supply place, they'll have seeds that aren't patented. So I think, I think there's some interesting groups going on. I think that's probably the way to do it.
Yeah, and I know there's the Seeds of Change.
Seeds of Change, yep.
Right, and they actually, Seeds of Change has branched out and actually has a product line that's in Whole Foods supermarkets. So we're giving Whole Foods a plug here.
I know.
But, you know, it's interesting when you go in there, they have conventional and they have organic.
Yeah.
So, you know, buy the organic, folks.
Well, I think it's great. You know, I think it's great when companies are successful selling healthy products, because really we live in a capitalist society. And, you know, I think the fact that Whole Foods is a very successful company that's, you know, that people flock to and they're absolutely packed only goes to show that people do want healthy food, and they want people who are paying attention to where things come from and what the effect is on our health. And I think that's positive, and it just raises the bar, which I think we need that raised bar now.
Well, Deborah, thanks so much for being on the program today. It's great to discuss this subject with you. My family and I are very passionate about it. So, again, thank you for your film. And, again, everyone, you can go to thefutureoffood.com to find out more and get a copy of the film and share it with your friends and family and community and show it at your church and whatever you want to do. But be informed about the subject. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Everyone, thanks for listening. That's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. I'd like to thank our engineers who helped put the show together, and especially to Tom Kirsch and the rest of the Catfish Groove Farm Band for our theme music. You can get more of their really cool tunes at catfishgroovefarm.com. And of course, you can find out more on the internet about Spirit of Film Conversations and the movies we talk about each week by going to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on SeventhWaveNetwork.com. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Libero for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.